Welcome to the Perimenopausal Mamas podcast for hormonal mamas who want to reclaim their own natural state of health to thrive and raise healthy kids. I'm Dr. Lisa Weeks, naturopathic doctor in Toronto, Canada, and I'm a perimenopausal mama to my little boy named Stuart.
And I'm Dr. Tony Reed, naturopathic doctor, birth doula, and hypnobirthing educator in Calgary, Canada, and I'm a perimenopausal mama to my little girl, Frankie. Thanks for supporting us for the past 100 episodes. Don't forget to subscribe and give us a rating and review wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also support us by visiting our Patreon page, where you can find out how you can join us for our monthly patron webinar, where we do a deeper dive discussion about all things perimenopause.
The information in this podcast is for educational and entertainment purposes only. It is not meant to substitute professional medical advice. Always consult with your licensed healthcare provider. Welcome back, everyone, to the Perimenopausal Mamas podcast. Today, I'm so excited to chat with Delphine Rule. She is the creator of what's called Access to Education. So she helps parents and kids with learning disabilities navigate the school system and get the support that they need. So I'll first introduce Delphine and then we'll get started. So Delphine is a mother, wife, teacher, school vice principal, and committed advocate for children with learning disabilities and learning exceptionalities. She believes that all children have the potential to make a difference, no matter how difficult their learning struggle might be. And she believes that the best way to unlock a child's potential is to build a network between parents, teachers, and school administrators with the common goal of elevating the child's success using the best combination of tools possible. Because she has dyslexia, a disability that two of her three children share with her, it has been part of her journey and that of her children's, and it's a challenge she's navigated proudly. When she became a parent, her own experience helped her to advocate for her children as their exceptionalities became evident. It is her life's work to navigate the uncharted territory of the educational system and make the process of advocating for children with learning exceptionalities easier and smoother. Now, she fights to open the eyes and ears of stubborn systems, not just for her and her children, but for you and yours. And that's why Access to Education was born. So welcome, Delphine.
Thanks so much, Lisa. I appreciate being on the show today.
Amazing. And you're a seasoned podcaster. I see you have own. So called Access to Education with the number 2 for those who are interested. Yeah. So how does it feel to be on the other side?
It's always strange. Every time I do this on the other side, I'm like, oh, is this what I put my poor guests through? But, yep. It's all good. It's fun. You know what?
I know it's the loss of control, right?
Right. Yeah. But it's quite lovely. It's lovely to, I think the thing about podcasts is that it allows different voices, right? And I think that the world is better for it because we can hear so many different voices and the voices that we think we most benefit from or we most share a commonality with. So that's what I really enjoy about it.
I love it. And I love some of the language you use. So you call it learning exceptionalities and disabilities with the abilities in capital letters. I think that's a really great way to explain it.
I can't take credit for that. You know what?
Okay.
I have to say, I totally can't take credit for it. I went to Brock University in St. Catharines here in Ontario for my undergrad. And that's how they described it. They had the DIS, the DIS portion in small letters, and the abilities in capitals. And I always thought, oh, I really love that. So I've just sort of kept that because I kind of wish that people would look at disabilities that way, where they would look at the person's abilities rather than the difference or the dis part of their ability, right? So
definitely. I love that.
I've adopted that as my own now.
Great. Go with it. Go with it. And you're immersed, in the educational system, obviously as a teacher, vice principal, parent. What inspired you to get into education and help kids with learning exceptionalities?
You know, the education part I fell into, to be perfectly honest, when I started out in undergrad, I was studying, I did an undergrad in a minor in physical education, I did a major in physical education with a minor in kinesiology. And my whole goal was to become a sports therapist. I wanted to work with sports teams. I wanted to work with athletes. That was like going to be the thing. And through some work experience that I had through university, I realized rather quickly that I didn't want to be on the road all the time, that living out of a suitcase was not high on my list of things to do. And physiotherapy, as much as I loved it, it didn't feel like a good fit. And so I came to the end of my 4 years and I'm like, okay, well, I have to do something. And I got to change roles a little bit. And I decided to go to Teachers College in Australia. Because
nice.
I have the marks. The Canadians, for whatever reason, the Canadian universities, you need astronomically high marks to get into Teachers College. And that's another conversation as to whether or not that's good or bad or where that comes out. But I could have gone to the States, but I thought, well, if I'm going to go somewhere, I might as well go somewhere. So I went over to Australia, got my teaching degree, came back and managed to get in the Toronto area into one of the school boards. And as soon as I became a teacher, I thought, you know what? I had such amazing special education teachers who are the reason or part of the reason. I mean, my parents are a bigger part of the reason, but my special education teachers are really a big part of the reason why I've done so well. So I was in what they would call an intensive support program. It's a small class. It's a separate program. It's a separate class. So from grade 2 to grade 8, I was pretty well in a class all day, or at least 50% of the day, with 8 other children and 2 teachers, an educational assistant and a classroom teacher, being provided really specific, targeted, directed support for what I needed to learn and to be a successful student. And I really credit that program with why I have done so well. I credit my parents for having fought to get me in the program. There was a little bit of resistance on the part of the school board, thinking I maybe wasn't in need of that program. But I will say that I really feel that it made the difference for me. If I hadn't had that really directed, structured, one-on-one, in some cases, support, I wouldn't have done so well. And I did as I got older and my skills got bigger and I learned how to navigate the education system. And I learned tricks to do math and to do reading and to do writing. And I learned how to use the resources around me and ask for help, which is not easy. I was able to be integrated into the regular program. So I remember being integrated for phys ed and eventually for sciences and eventually for, you know, math and languages and things. It slowly, you know, the release was there slowly, which also I think went a long way to, you know, having me be here. So that by the time I got to university, I'd really gained the skills. I wasn't in a small class placement through high school, but I had learned at that point how to advocate for myself. Which for anyone who's ever advocated for themselves for any reason at any age, it's really hard to do. But it's a really important skill for parents who have children who have learning difficulties or exceptionalities, but even more so important for that individual person as they grow up to have the confidence to stand up and say, you know what, in order to be a successful learner, here are the things that I'm going to need, which then actually what I'm having a lot of conversations about actually translates over into the working environment of, I can be a really good employee for you, but in order to be that, I need whatever the things are that they're going to need. So it certainly was a learning and growing experience. So that takes me back to why did I go into education? Went into education because I wanted to teach special education and focus my learning and my teaching environment in that mindset. So here I am 20 some odd years later now working as a vice principal. And supporting many different students at many different levels, from ESL students to students with exceptionalities to just your average everyday student. But it's been a very interesting up and down, and it changes constantly. And I'm trying to always keep up with the latest information, but I certainly enjoy it.
Amazing. That's quite, yeah, the journey. And you've been through the program. Some of the programs are offerings that the school system had on tap growing up. So you see what works, what doesn't work. And you were able to join some of the classes after you felt, you know, you found some tricks and ways to navigate your learning so that it worked for you. And then for you, with your learning difficulty, how was it picked up and by who and when?
So it's funny, I've asked my mom this question a couple times, and every time we talk about it, I think she changes the story ever so slightly. But my memory of it is that she was realizing that I wasn't necessarily meeting the developmental goals that my peers were. So we would go to playdates and things would be different. I never wanted to read. I had no interest in books. My parents are voracious readers. I repel at the look of a book. I would much rather, you know, I don't know, paint walls than read a book. Reading is not an enjoyable activity for me. It's a lot of work. It requires a lot of focus and attention. It's just not a pleasurable activity for me. So I have veered over to audiobooks, which I adore and I love and allow me to be part of that culture of reading. And I'm so grateful that those things are in existence. So my mom realized that something was a bit amiss. My mother is also originally from France. So she had me going to school in French initially and was very concerned that the French language was the reason that trying to learn two languages was the reason for the learning disability. Needless to say, in about grade one, early grade two, she had me privately assessed by a psychologist in something called a psychoeducational assessment, which just really is a fancy way of saying, I went into a room and I played a bunch of games and I did a bunch of math and I did some memory stuff and some puzzles and some word games and a few fun things. And that came out with a particular response that basically was, nope, I was fine. And my mother could continue on her merry way. But this is where my parents' advocacy kind of shines through and how I've sort of kind of modeled things a little bit for my own kids. In fact, she really wasn't quite satisfied with that report. She felt that something wasn't it. For her and her parent gut, we often talk about that parental gut thing that we have. Mm-hmm. She just felt that didn't feel right. So she had me assessed a second time. And that second assessment came out with a very defined learning disability, which is dyslexia. And everybody at school thought it was, you know, attentional things, put her on Ritalin, do all these things. And in fact, that wasn't it at all. So it was really my mom at the early age of, I might have been 7 or 8, and I don't remember the initial psychoed assessments, but I remember the previous, the following one. So I had one done just before I went to high school and then one just before I went into post-secondary school. So those ones, I have very vivid memories of doing those assessments. And then I had my own kids assessed, and what a strange thing it was to sit on the other side of the table with my children and watch them do almost exactly the same assignments and to watch them struggle in some of the places that I struggled. And it was very interesting. It was a very strange place to be in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And our kids, like, are these learning challenges or difficulties commonly picked up like grade one, grade two, or what do you see?
Yeah. So, I mean, they can be found quite early. There's a lot of studies. There's an Ontario Human Rights Commission report that just came out called The Right to Read. And it talks a lot about how we can put in early interventions and see in kindergarten or sometimes preschool which children and where they might struggle in learning. So, you know, picking up the alphabet, learning how to count, tying your shoes, being able to speak. So children who have a speech delay can often be more prone to having some sort of exceptionality. It has to do with the synapses and connections in the brain and all of those good things. You know, some children won't speak, but they understand very well. So their receptive language is quite good, but their expressive, their ability to speak maybe isn't there. And sometimes those can be indicators. If children are really disengaged in school, if they're not wanting to learn things, you know, if it's not coming easily, if you're having to reteach. So if you're, you know, your child is in grade one or grade two and the teacher is saying to you, well, yesterday we talked about, you know, I'm going to make up an example of like 4 + 4 = 8. You know, and that's something that would sort of, you know, eventually come fairly quickly. But if the teacher is saying over and over again, you know, I teach something and then they don't remember it, or we have to reteach it to get the solidification of the knowledge, that's the kind of thing that should be sort of little ding, ding, dings. There's something not quite going on here, quite right. Social interactions as well. So if your children have trouble socializing, so one of my eldest, his LD was really initially, we did a developmental assessment because he was acting out at his little play group when he was about 3. He was really resistant to dealing with change and the things that were happening, and he would hit other children. He was speaking full sentences at 18 months. So, right. Remember wow. I said sometimes mm-hmm. speaking is an issue, but he was speaking at 18 months, but it's at 3 years old. And then in preschool, his behavior was just, I mean, really, it was maddening for me, embarrassing for me. Like it was mm-hmm. all those things. But what we did was we had a developmental assessment done at our local hospital. It was covered by our OHIP because it was done through the hospital and through our doctor. And there were markers already early on for attention deficit hyperactivity. And there was also a bit of a talk of, you know, maybe there's a learning disability in there because of the family history. So family history can also be a little trigger for you to say, oh, maybe this is something. It very often learning disabilities are genetic. The more they look into it, the more they're discovering that it actually is just a genetic thing. It is not anything that the parent has done. And I think that's something that's really important to get to parents is that you as a parent, you did not do anything before you got pregnant, during your pregnancy, after your pregnancy. It's just the way your child was made. Mm-hmm. And it really isn't. There would have been nothing you could have done differently. And I certainly can speak from personal experience over the guilt of my children struggling at school. I've certainly had many days of, you know, sitting on the floor, just really thinking, oh my God, I did this. It's my fault. My children are never going to. And listen, here I am as the person who's been through it. Right. So mm-hmm. I think we all need to kind of allow ourselves as parents to have a moment to go, oh, that's really crummy. And I thought it was going to go a different way and it's not. And now I need to figure out where we go from here. So, it can be hard to know where the issues are, but I would really say if you have school age children and the teachers are really saying they're not remembering, they're having a difficult time in class, they're not paying attention, they're acting out, they're seeking attention, they're disruptive, they're not engaging. Those would all be sort of things to pay attention to. And if they're really young, you know, what is their ability to understand spoken language? What is their ability to speak? And then, you know, how are they in social situations? Do they get along well with others? Is it difficult? You know, the transition's hard. And just conversation with your family doctor is always, whenever I work with clients, I always say to them, the first thing you need to do is have a conversation with your family doctor, because they can get you in to see professionals like a developmental pediatrician who can look at your child on the spectrum of all the other children their age, and where does your child fit in there? And is there anything that indicates that maybe more resources are required to ensure that your child is successful? Not because they can't be, but because the earlier you can put in the resources and the support, the more beneficial and the more positive outcome you will find.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I recall I was doing really well in school until about grade six, and then I couldn't see the board and I'd be called on it and I'd be embarrassed. And I just thought, like, I didn't know what was going on. And I'm like, how come I can't answer these questions now? And it was found out that I just needed glasses. So I can imagine kids that are, you know, going through school, kindergarten, grade one, grade two, they're not, you know, doing maybe what some of their peers are doing, or they're finding these challenges and they don't have reasons why. And it can really challenge their self-confidence, you know, how they feel about themselves in relation to their peers. So I love that you're about early detection. And it sounds like there are some, you know, the signs and symptoms you listed are very valuable for our listeners to hear, things that kind of stand out, and listen to your gut instinct, and then have, you know, the conversation with the teacher, with the family doctor, and get, can you talk a little bit more about that assessment at the hospital?
Yeah. So the assessment at the hospital, they look at a couple of different things. So they often have a speech language pathologist who will come in and speak to the child and talk about, you know, sort of do, they'll give them simple instructions. Can they follow, you know, 2 and 3 step instructions? Can they carry on a conversation? Is there eye contact? So those are the sorts of things that the speech language pathologist might look at. If they're not able to articulate their words very well, is there something with the child's physical mouth, the way their mouth presents? Does the tongue sit properly? Do they know how to use their tongue to create the sounds? Mm-hmm. A lot of us take for granted that when you say th, the TH sound, we just use our tongue to say th. But if you don't know that that's what you're supposed to do with your tongue, or if you don't know that, you know, you push your lips together to make the mm sound, right? Those sorts of things. I think we all really just think, oh, this just happens. It's not for all children. Some children need to explicitly be taught how to do these things. There's often a occupational therapist who will often come in. So they'll take a look at the child's ability to sit up. Can they do like the wheelbarrow? So if you have children and you pick up their feet and they walk on their hands, my boys couldn't do the wheelbarrow. They have very, very low muscle tone in their hands and their arms. And you say, well, how is that an indication of anything? Well, they don't like to write with a pencil. So holding a pencil,
right.
They would not hold a pencil. It's hard work to hold a pencil. And if you have low muscle tone in your hands, holding a pencil all day, it's exhausting. So you choose not to write, right? So instead of, you know, sitting and doing the paperwork, you're off doing something else. And the teacher's like, little Jimmy, come and sit down and do your work. And Jimmy's going to say, well, I don't want to do that, right? And then you get that sort of, it can sometimes be perceived that the child is trying to be defiant. Well, it's not that they're being defiant. It's that it hurts to write, but they don't know how to tell you that. So having a developmental assessment can look at those sorts of things. You often get a pediatrician who comes in and, you know, make sure that they're growing and that they're seeing correctly, that they're hearing properly. Oftentimes when we're in school team meetings, we often ask parents, well, when was the last time you had their sight checked? When was the last time you had their hearing checked? Those are quick little things as parents that if you think something's going on, quick little trip to the optometrist, no big deal. They read the chart. I mean, if you've been there with wee ones, they don't even ask them the alphabets. You don't have to worry about whether or not they know the letters. It tends to be, is there a car and a truck and what is the order? Just to make sure that they can see a hearing test, no big deal. One of my kids, I think it was my middle kid, failed his early infant screenings. And so we had to go back for a myriad of other tests to ensure that he was hearing properly. So we've always kind of been on top of his hearing and those sorts of things. So yeah, the developmental assessment, I mean, it's a long name that sounds really scary, but it's really just a group of professionals. So speech language pathologist, occupational therapist, probably a physician in there of some sort of three really great resources that can take a look at everything your child is able to do and look at all of the wonderful strengths that they have, because there will be many. And then they will look at the few things that they can't do. So, you know, maybe they understand 2 and 3 step directions, but their memory isn't so great. So you need to give them slower, or you need to, you know, give 1 step at a time. Maybe, you know, as my own kids had, they have some fine motor skill issues or some gross motor skill issues. So knowing those things early, and then you can start working with speech language pathologists, occupational therapists, whoever it is, physical therapists, if you need to, right? Pull that team in, put the child at the center, put the team around the child to lift the child and ensure that they're successful.
I love that holistic assessment and approach, because it could be stemming from so many different areas of the body or have so many different causes. And I guess it could be possibly more than one too. So I love that approach of the vision, the hearing assessment, you know, fine motor skills, gross motor skills, memory. So that's a very holistic approach. And then when it comes time to like understanding the child's challenges, is it like a spectrum, or are there common learning difficulty kind of categories that you see?
Yeah. So exceptionalities fall in kind of their own. And to speak about schools specifically, each school board has their own sort of definitions of learning disabilities and where they fit. So autism would fit under sort of one umbrella in schools. Dyslexia would fall under another. You know, and there's physical disabilities, and there's developmental disabilities, and there's developmental delays. There's different ones, and they don't all follow the same pattern, and they're not all the same. There will be some similarities, and there will be some quote unquote generalization. So generally, for a dyslexic person, for example, reading is often the telltale that something is reading and writing. If they can't do those things, is often the telltale. People often think of, for example, autism, the telltale is that they don't maybe make eye contact, or they're very socially not aware, right? Mm-hmm. So you think of those sort of generalizations. But I really need to emphasize the fact that every child in every case is going to be different. Just like, you know, some children have blue eyes and some children have brown eyes. You're not going to have the same story. And my story with my children is one way. I certainly have met many people through both my educational career and my consulting career, where sure, there are intersectionalities when things are sort of the same in terms of maybe the age of understanding of the learning disability or sort of the path they took to get there. But no two children are identical and no two assessments are ever going to be, you know, ever really the same. And the strengths of one child will be different to another. But mm-hmm. I really think it's important that the sooner parents can support their child and the sooner parents can understand the strengths of their child, but also very importantly, where there are weaknesses and how they can build those weaknesses. So occupational therapists, physiotherapists, doctors, speech language pathologists, a tutor maybe very specifically for maybe just math or a very specific type of reading tutoring that supports the child in learning how to read. Putting all those things in place at an early age stops the frustration that many older children feel when they begin to be more aware of their differences. Mm-hmm. That gets tricky. So to your point of grade six, right, you were very aware at the board that other people knew that something wasn't right because you couldn't see the board.
Yeah.
Grade one or grade two, even kindergarten, they're aware of their peers, but there isn't so much of that peer pressure to be a certain way, right? They're all just in a class together and they're all just trying to figure it out. Whereas by the time you get to sort of middle school, you get to grade four, grade five, sometimes even in grade three, the social pressures to be a particular way can inhibit a child's want to really look different and be different.
Definitely.
So that also is a challenge.
Definitely. So yeah, it's good to know with the approach, it's obviously individualized. And that's where someone like you comes in because you're helping families navigate the systems and supports that are out there and act kind of like a gatekeeper, right? So it's like a strategic plan, start here. These are the steps we're going to take for you and your child.
Yeah, it's very much a roadmap. I call it a roadmap. I was just speaking to a client the other day and she said, you know, you really gave me permission to go into the school and ask for the things. It's very hard to know as parents, and I've certainly 100% been there, even working in the system and having an LD, but I've been that parent who's up Googling at all hours of the night trying to be like, I don't understand my kid and what can I do and how can I figure it out and what should we do first and what do we do next and what do I ask the school for and how do I do this and that? And it really just is a case of meeting with the client, talking about the child as a whole and looking at the whole child, looking at all the things they're good at, all the things that they need support with, and then what are the main things we need to look at first? So maybe it's just learning how to read. That's the first thing. Okay, so let's find someone to help with that. Okay, great. We found someone for that. Let's move on to the next thing. The individual education plan at the school maybe isn't meeting their needs. Let's take a look at that. And what can we put into that as a parent and helping them advocate for what they really feel that their child needs? Because yes, as teachers and educators and administrators, we know the children in our building. 100%. We know who they are. We know they're struggling. We know all of these things and we're trying to put things in place. But at the end of the day, you are the child's parent. You have known them since birth. You have seen what they've struggled with. You know what they gravitate to. You know what they'll recoil from. And so that those pieces of information are incredibly valuable in looking at the team that needs to support this child. And having the parents alongside us as educational staff members and even any other outside resources, really just understanding how everybody's working together to ensure that we're building this child up to be as successful as they can be.
Mm-hmm. So it's very collaborative. And then what sort of supports are already offered in the school system that parents may not know about? And then, you know, outside of that, what other resources can people tap into privately or even publicly outside of the school?
So within the school system, the best way to get support is to meet with the classroom teacher and ask about what does that school or school board offer. The school board I have currently, we have social workers on staff. We have speech language pathologists. We have psychologists. We have some occupational therapists. And there are some programs, specific programs geared towards children with learning exceptionalities or neurodiversities who require what we call intensive support programs. So that would be smaller classes really geared towards them and their needs. For the most part, most school boards are now working on what we call an integrated model. So working very, very hard to have children with exceptionalities and learning needs within their regular class with their regular peers, which is great. I think there's lots of advantages to that, but there are going to be some students who don't benefit from that. So the school board has access to some outside resources for occupational therapy, physical therapies. You would be put on wait lists. Some of these lists, depending on where you are in the province, are longer than others. In the school board I work in, some of the waits are quite long, and we're recording this in pandemic, at the end of pandemic. I don't know.
We'll find out. Hopefully the end. Yeah. It's more endemic. Let's keep our fingers crossed.
But the last 2 years through the pandemic has certainly not helped things in terms of wait lists and things, right? Because everything's closed and then there's sort of the backlog. So that would be within the school system. I would really encourage parents to reach out to their school themselves, find out who the special education teacher is for your school, and have a conversation with them and say, you know, what can we offer? What could be offered within the school system, and how do we access them?
Nice.
There are many, many agencies that support families with various neurodiversities. So Surrey Place is one that works with students who have autism. There's Blue Review also. There's the International Dyslexia Association, IDAO. They support children with learning disabilities and dyslexia specifically. There's a website called CADA, which is, and I always forget what the acronym is, but it's basically a wealth of knowledge for attention deficit hyperactivity, as well as many other resources. There's Autism Canada. There's many here in the city of Toronto. There's a fabulous agency that I've been involved with my own kids called Integra Child Development Institute. And they focus in on children with learning disabilities, ADHD, and anxiety. You sort of send over your child's psychoed report and you talk to, I think, TAKE worker about what is it that your child is struggling with and how can they support. I've sent my eldest to a camp called Camp Kirk, which is a camp that specializes in kids with neurodiversities, from ADHD to autism to seizure activity. And those camps are wondrous respites for parents, but also wonderful opportunities for children to just be kids and to play with friends and to interact and learn how to, you know, kind of function day to day. So there's a ton of resources and agencies. But what I will say is that it can be very hard to know exactly which one to go to. We fell into a clinic in the west end of the city, not super close to our house, but because they were providing such amazing work, we would drive the 45 minutes to them. It's called the Red Oak Center, and they're a multi-service center with psychologists, occupational therapists, speech language pathologists, physical therapists, tutors. I mean, they're all under one roof, and my children had lots of success doing some sensory work over there, some social groups to learn how to be a little more leveled or leveled, I don't even know what word I'm looking for, but a little better monitored in their behavior in class when they get frustrated and those sorts of things. So there are a myriad of different resources that parents can access. But again, it's really a case of figuring out what is the need and then what will help with that need. So you really have to identify, what is the goal here? Do you want them to read? Do you want them to not be angry? Do you need them to work on their self-regulation? Like, really, what is the first thing that you want to pinpoint, and then finding the resources from there?
Yeah, so start with that assessment. And then it sounds really promising that, you know, the support can extend beyond the classroom and sitting at a desk. It can be at a camp. It can be with other types of tools and technology. In terms of technology, how have you seen that hinder learning in kids, and how can it help kids?
I don't, you know, I would like to say I have a lot of hindrances for technology, but I honestly don't.
Okay, great.
I had parents who were very against my using a calculator. I will be very honest, in my 40s now, I still struggle with some basic math skills, but I carry a calculator in my pocket every day. I don't know any of us who don't.
Yeah, I have it on my phone.
But that's what I mean, right?
Yeah,
we all have it on our phones. We all have access to it. So when I was younger, it I felt different because I was always pulling a calculator and doing all these things. Now it's like everybody and their uncle pulls it. I mean, my children use, we have an Echo in our kitchen, and they use, you know, Echo, what's this times this. And then it helps them figure it out.
Was that like a Siri specific for math or?
No.
It's just like a Siri in general.
Yeah. It's a Siri thing.
Yeah.
What I will say on the math topic and using the calculator, the importance needs to be placed on when we're looking at math is, do they understand the concept of why you're using the operation that you're using? So why would you use addition versus subtraction? Why would you use multiplication over addition, right? Understanding the why or the how it works. So addition is getting bigger, subtraction is getting smaller, dividing is breaking it up, multiplying is again making it bigger amongst groups of things, right?
Mm-hmm.
If they can understand the reason for the addition, the subtraction, whatever the, if you're talking about algebra, you know, why you're putting in that particular formula, then there's no reason why they can't use a calculator, because all it does is remove the barrier that makes it difficult. So they understand the concept. Now, all you're saying to them is, okay, well, here's a tool that can make it easier. You know the concept. Let's not get stuck on the, you can't do it because you can't figure out what 12 times 12 is.
Right.
You know why we're doing it. Here's the thing to take away the hindrance, right?
Totally. Yeah.
In reading, I mean, now it's amazing. I mean, screens read to you. They don't read to you. You can voice to text. You can text to voice. You, I mean, it's honestly, I love the predictable text. It has helped me learn how to spell things that I, for the life of me, was having so many issues with spelling as a kid. And it makes me feel okay when I send emails. I don't worry that my emails are wrong, right? And my spelling, I personally think, has come quite a long ways.
Great.
Because I'm like, oh, that's how that sound works. Okay, well, now I understand and I'll remember that, right? So, and for our kids who, I mean, my two boys with their executive functioning, they are terribly, terribly organized. I am organized to the ninth. They are like, I don't know, my thing is over here and the homework's over there and I don't really know. But Google Calendar has really made a difference for my 12-year-old in grade 7 this year. He's putting everything into his Google Calendar, due dates, the like when he handed it in, when it's due, how long he's got to do it, those sorts of things. Because, like you said, they're in the palm of his hand. They're in his phone all the time.
Right.
Those things have been really helpful. And all they do, for me anyway, and in our house, is they take away the hindrance. They remove the thing that causes the stress and the anxiety over, I can't do it because I don't like writing. I can't do it because I can't remember my addition and multiplication facts. I can't do it because the reading passage is too long. But if they have a piece of technology that reads it to them, they understand the passage. The understanding isn't the problem. It's the sitting down and reading that becomes very laborious for them, which then means they lose interest and they stop paying attention and then they don't understand. So now we're doing, you know, the assignments will get read to them. They'll sit and the words are highlighted. So they're practicing their reading skills at the same time. And they're involved and they're engaged in their learning, which for me is a plus, plus, plus. And I say, if the technology is there, and it's so much better than when I was in university and high school. I mean, it was, I didn't have half the stuff. And the things we did have, we had something called Dragon. And I always talk about this program, Dragon. You had to train the Dragon. It had to recognize your voice. And it was hours and and hours of training. And I was like, this is not worth it. I will just type up my essays. But it was fairly laborious. It was not an easy task for me. So yeah, I think technology is awesome. I think you need to be open to it and you need to see what pieces work and what pieces don't, right? It's not going to work for everybody. And what works, again, right? This is how we're all very individual. What works for one might not work for another. So you have to kind of play with it. I'm not great on Google Calendar. I still like to write it down in an agenda, but I'm, again, in my 40s. That's how I've grown up, right?
Yeah.
Down. My kids don't live in that world. They live in the world where they open up their Google Calendar, they open up Enter New, and they speak into the microphone. It types it out for them, and then they save it, and they're off to the races. My son doesn't even write in an agenda. He actually takes a picture of the homework board.
Oh, brilliant.
Yeah. Well, because writing is a problem, right? He doesn't like to write. He will do whatever he can to get out of it. So he snaps a quick picture of the homework board, and then he has his homework.
I love it. So it sounds like, yeah, there's lots of ways to use technology to make learning easier. I recall in university, I had a friend who had ADHD and he had this like program that would highlight the text as he was reading it on the computer. And I think that's when I first, like, I kind of heard about learning disabilities. I knew there was like a special education class, you know, in grade school, but it wasn't really talked about, right? Do you feel like, is it normalized more now and peers and classmates are aware and accepting?
Yes, I think it's getting there. I think that there's less of a there's less of a stigma around it. I think we're starting to understand it more. I think we're beginning to know that it's not a bad thing, that it's simply a different way of thinking. These students with exceptionalities bring in such a rich, different way of looking at problems in the work world. Because they just see things from a different perspective and a different angle. So yeah, I think it's being talked about more. I think as we're talking about mental health more, right? That's the other thing. There's often a mental health piece that comes along with it because sometimes there can be a shame piece and all these things. So because we're opening the door to conversation, and so for example, this conversation that you and I are having, right? 10 or 15 years ago, I don't know that we would have been talking about it this openly. But I'm certainly finding in lots of forums on epilepsy, autism, Down syndrome, developmental delayed, all those sorts of things, we're really seeing an acceptance, a growth, and a want to understand, which I think just makes us better.
Mm-hmm, for sure. That's so key. Yeah. Just to understanding someone's journey and what they're going through and not, you know, judging or labeling or shaming, I think is so important. So I'm so happy to hear there's lots of resources through support systems, through technology. This question might be too big for today, but in terms of the pandemic, how has that hindered learning or helped learning? if it's too big, don't worry. We don't have to go there.
It's a big question. Yeah. I can probably synthesize it a little bit. Listen, the pandemic has affected all children. It's affected, I think, our children with learning needs and exceptionalities, whether they're developmentally delayed, whether they have a physical disability, whether they have just a plain old learning disability, whether they're, you know, Down syndrome, autism, any of those. Because what it's actually done, or what I'm finding anyway in the schools that I'm in right now, is the socialization piece. We've been away from each other for so long that we've forgotten how to be in a classroom together and how to be in social situations with kids. And so there's a lot of relearning happening. And listen, I'm a full-time working parent. So I'm the first one to raise my hand and say, yeah, there were days where I don't know if my kids logged in. They told me they logged in. I think they did. I can't guarantee it because I couldn't be beside them. And my hat goes off to all of those parents who really put the emphasis on their children's education and sat beside them every day, you know, 5 days a week for 10 months to get them through it. But learning online is not something that works for many students. Many students need that physical presence of a teacher, you know, of a classroom with the anchor charts around them that give them the reinforcement of what they're learning. And I will say I have had on my staff some phenomenal online teachers. They have taught classes online exclusively for the last 2 or 3 years now, and they have done an amazing job at it. But to my mind, there are a lot of children who need to be back in the classroom where they are getting the back and forth interaction, not only with their peers, but with their classroom teacher and what's around them in the classroom. So I think we are going to start to see some fairly big delays and differences between what we see now in grade one and what we would have seen 3 or 4 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense.
I don't think it's insurmountable. I think we can quote unquote fix it, but everybody's going to have to be patient. And, you know, we have to let children get through this. People keep saying kids are resilient, and yeah, they're resilient, but like, it's not easy. Like, we've asked a lot of our children, don't play with your friends. Don't do this. Don't do that. Be careful. Put your mask on. Like, it wasn't a picnic for them either. Right. So I think we forget that sometimes, because I think we use that word resilient, just like, and our kids have taken on a pretty big burden here. So I think over the next few years, we'll see a bell swing to the other way, but it's going to take some time. And we're all, as parents, as educators, as teachers, as society, we're going to have to take a minute and say, okay, we're going to all figure it out. but we can't put too much pressure on any one group or any one person.
Definitely. I'm glad we're not moving to like the work model as a hybrid model of, you know, in-person and virtual. I'm glad the schools are planning to stay fully in-person. Thank goodness.
Yeah, exactly.
It wouldn't work. So those are some great things to explore in terms of supports for kids. Are there any other ways a parent, yourself, or other systems could support a child with these learning exceptionalities?
I think it's super, super important that parents be honest with their children and really be honest with your child about what their struggles are. Talk to them a lot about what their strengths are. Play into that. Then talk to them about, you know, what the things are that maybe they don't do so well and how can you help them and how can they understand it. And be open about it. And listen, I find parents often are very afraid of the label. So they don't want their child to be labeled as dumb or stupid or any of those things. Those aren't words that are used in the education system anymore. We use the term that the child has. So in my case, my children are labeled in their school system as being dyslexic because that is who and what they are. That's just so important that we empower the child to understand who they are and what makes them special and what makes them do well and maybe what is more difficult. But also, I think to give the child back the power. So often I think children who struggle at school feel that they're no good, that they're useless. They have that sort of self-talk that can be very deprecating, self-deprecating. And by giving them the power to understand, I think really helps build their confidence. I know it did for me. I know it does for my own children. We talk about it openly at the dinner table. My six-year-old daughter, who as of yet, knock on wood, I'm knocking on anything I can, isn't showing any signs of a learning disability or reading difficulty or any of those things. But she understands that people in her class learn differently and that things are not as easy for everyone as they are for her. I mean, she's very, very good at math. I mean, she's, you know, quite good at it, actually. She's better than me. But she's learning that everyone is different. Everybody has their strengths. And so that conversation in our house about what is easy for daddy is not easy for mommy. And what is easy for one of her brothers is not so easy for the other, right? So just having really open, honest conversations. And whether you're in a neurotypical household and you all learn the same way and nobody has struggles, I think having conversations with children about the fact that not everybody is good at everything, and that's okay. And bringing your strength to the table is what's important. So I would say that, I don't know if that answers the question.
Yeah, it does. Yeah. So discussion about it, communication. Yeah. Just normalizing and, you know, talking about other people's experiences and ways that they learn too is so valuable.
So much more interesting. I mean, if we were all the same, I keep saying this to everybody, it would be such a boring world.
Yeah, this is true. I wouldn't be talking to you. I'd be talking to myself right now.
We'd all be doing the same thing and be like, oh, I don't need to talk to them. We're doing the same thing. You know, it's like in university and teachers college, I went to school. I was living with, going to school with and teaching in the same classroom as one of my roommates. And it got to the point where we were like, I don't want to see you anymore. I have nothing to talk to you about. Like literally we were living the same life.
Yep.
And it's just not so much fun.
No, we need to celebrate our differences. Exactly. So that's what your program and your support does. So can you kind of just tell me a little bit about what does it look like if someone wants to work with you? What does that process look like?
So there's a couple different ways. One of the, I guess the most popular way to work with me to start is many families book a 1-hour consultation with me. And in that 1-hour consultation, we talk about where you are now and where your biggest struggle is. And I try to give you some directionality, a little bit of a roadmap, kind of get you set up in the right direction. So we do that in about an hour. And then I have one of the other ways is two different month-long packages. So there's a 3-month or a 6-month. And in those things, we look at the individual education plan. We look at advocacy support. We look at meeting support. Sometimes, honestly, with a couple of my clients, it's just been a meeting every now and again where I sit and listen and we talk and the parents kind of talk about all the things that are going well and then the things that really aren't going well, and just a chance to kind of voice that. I also sometimes work with the children themselves if there's particular things as a family that you want to work on.
I also do work with parents on understanding their child's individual education plan or their IEP and allow their voice to really be heard within the document. So I actually get a hold of it. We have a meeting. I take it away. I do all kinds of edits and changes. We meet, and then it's up to the parents to take it back to the school. And then I do advocacy support that is just for school team meetings, doctor's appointments, those sorts of things, or if they're going to an individual placement recommendation committee. That's a bigger kind of board level meeting, and I support them through that as well.
All right. You've got a lot of different roles that you can take on and lots of options for support. So how can people connect with you and find you?
Mm-hmm. So my website is access2education.com. So that's the word access with the number 2education.com. That's my website. And I'm on Instagram at Access to Education Toronto and Facebook at Access to Education Toronto as well. And I'm on Pinterest, sort of, but it's all Access to Education Toronto, really, on all the various socials. And then, as you said off the top, I have a podcast where I talk to experts, professionals, doctors, you name it. But I also talk to families about their journeys and their struggles and their perspectives on what their experience has been, which is always really nice to share. And I've even had my kids on the show. We've talked about their journeys a little bit. I talk about my journey as well. So that's also Access to Education. And that's pretty well anywhere you get your podcasts.
I love what you're doing. And I took a look at the podcast because I didn't actually realize you had one. And there's so many that I want to listen to. You have so many great topics, and you're really filling a need for so many parents and kids out there and helping them create that individualized roadmap and navigate systems that they might not even realize exist. So I just want to thank you for that and for sharing your wisdom and knowledge today. Did we cover everything you wanted to before we move to the next part?
I've
been picking your brain. So the next part of the podcast, we ask our super mom moment. So I can go first if you want.
Sure.
My super mom moment is just modeling movement and being active. So I work out in the morning, and if Stuart gets up, he'll come downstairs, and I always offer for him to work out with me. Of course, I don't get the same intensity of exercise, but he'll do some moves with me and, you know, plank and push up and things like that. And then maybe he'll go watch some YouTube on his YouTube Kids on his computer. But and then we do really try to walk frequently to and from school, even if it's bad weather. So it's just no excuses. So I'll celebrate that. That's my super mom moment, because movement and being active is so important for my mental health and wellness that I'm trying to, you know, show him that it's easy to fit in. So, well, there's simple ways to fit it in. It becomes a routine. And what's your super mom moment, Delphi?
You know what? We had one just this past March break. We went away. Lisa and I, you and I were talking about this off the top. And my son was being a little bit bullied by someone in the kids group that he was in.
Oh no.
And I actually was witness to an incident at one point. My husband kept saying, oh, don't get involved. Don't get involved. And I thought, no, you know what? I am going to get involved. I am going to. Anyhow, so I sort of went over and stood up for him a little bit and sort of just very directly said to the individual, you know what, you're just being a bully, and my son and I are going to go away now. And what's really interesting about that is that he speaks to a social worker once every other week just to sort of help with some anxiety. And the social worker, we meet with her every so often, and she said, you know, he really felt validated because you stepped in. And I really felt like you saw him in that moment. And I thought, oh, okay, good. Because sometimes, you know, as parents, we think, oh gosh, I shouldn't have stepped in there. But it was nice confirmation that I had done the right thing. So that at the moment,
that's a really good super mom
that's
moment.
That's my super mom moment.
Thank you for sharing. You had the cape on and you swooped in.
Well, and sometimes you worry, right? As a parent, you're like, I know. Is that too much? But I'm glad it wasn't.
So for sure. Yeah. Sometimes they do need that help, right? And that support. So we'll move to our mama mess up. I can go first.
Just one?
Just one. I know. There's too many for me to list in, you know, a minute or two. But for Stuart, his running shoes were all ripped and broken. So he was having to wear boots even when it was like warm days. So we finally got out and got him some running shoes this weekend. So now he's able to wear running shoes and no more boots when it's not necessary. So as moms, you know, sometimes we get behind in the supplies for our kids. So that was a bit of a mess up. But what's yours, Delphine?
you know what? Mine is a very, very similar thing. I think we're living parallel lives momentarily. I have a 10-year-old who is growing like a damn weed, honest to goodness. And he kept saying, "Mom, my shoes are too tight." I'm thinking, I just bought you these shoes like a couple months ago. They're fine. And of course, this morning I was going in late, so I had time to kind of help him get ready. And I'm like, "Why don't your shoes fit? What's happening?" And I'm like hollering at him and I'm trying to shove his foot in. And I'm finally like, clearly these do not fit. So I had just bought his older brother this weekend shoes, but I'm clearly going to have to do the same for him.
Right.
So my mess up is I just don't listen to my children very well when they tell me things are too small, because I'm convinced that they're not.
Well, we're shrinking. We're not growing. It's right? Hard to remember how quickly we grew as kids. So yeah, it blows my mind, which brings me to my mama must have is getting secondhand clothing from, we went to Value Village yesterday actually and got his shoes there, but there's also Little One's Closet on the Danforth and Once Upon a Child here in Toronto. So those are definitely our go-tos, because who wants to buy new when they're going to grow out of it in like however many months? So that's my mama must have, secondhand clothes from those shops. What's your mama must have, Delphine?
My mama must have is a tag on my keys, my car keys, so that I have a hope in heck of finding them.
Nice.
I'm often coming in the door with armloads of things from the car because apparently children can't carry their own backpacks into the house. And I will put everything down in a heap and inevitably my keys will go or someone will move my key. Anyhow. Never mind. I have a new thing on my phone now that I can make it make a very annoying buzzing sound so that I can find my keys, because otherwise we can't go anywhere. So
I didn't know that existed. Okay. Well, good to know.
It's the best thing ever. It's the best thing. I'm constantly misplacing my keys. And so, my husband bought it for me, Mother's Day, maybe my birthday, Christmas, one of those anyhow.
All right.
It's been a lifesaver because it's connected to my phone with Bluetooth and then I can make it sing and do it so that then I can find it. Because when my children were little, it was a fun game. They would hide my keys on me. So that's my must have. So it's not very exciting. And it's
it makes your life so much easier. So I can appreciate that. So, yes.
Yeah, exactly.
Those are the invaluable ones. So anything that helps. But thank you so much, Delphine, for joining us. And we'll link to all of your, you know, social media accounts, your website in our show notes. And I'll have to have you back on to pick your brain even further, because there's so much we could have talked about. But I think you gave such valuable information. So thank you. And I'll just briefly review what I and Dr. Tony have coming up. So I have my Wild Collective Spring enrollment is open now. So go to wildcollectivetoronto.com. I have a few spots left. It's a combination of in-person and virtual sessions. So there's 3 in-person and 7 virtual out of the 10 modules. So it's going to be extra special this time. So get on the wait list there and I'll pass on the details. And Dr. Tony has a hypnobirthing class series starting in April. You can get a free online masterclass to reduce fear and anxiety around birth if you go to www.hypnobirthingcalgary.com. And thank you everybody for joining us today. You can email us or connect with us on Facebook and Instagram. We'd love you to subscribe, leave us a review and a 5-star rating if you enjoyed this episode. And you can also support us by visiting our Patreon page. So also tell your perimenopausal mama friends about us too. So stay safe and healthy. Until next time, thanks, Delphine.
Thanks so much, Lisa.
Bye.
Bye.